True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates on this case and discussions as we have them. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod for more on this case and many others as well. Today, we're going to be discussing the extended gag order that we've been talking about since last week. Many media outlets actually forming coalitions objecting to the extended gag order that was issued by the judge in the Koberger case. Today, we're going to talk to Lori Gilbertson. She's a former prosecutor. We're going to dive into that and even go much deeper into how all of this is being handled, what we can expect, if there's any surprises possibly down the road in the next handful of weeks, months, as we lead up to June 26th. Lori, welcome to the program and thank you for joining us. Let's start there. What was your reaction to that extended gag order that was put into place last week by the judge?
Yeah, you know, I was really surprised when I saw that second kind of amendment to the gag order, to the dissemination of information order. I have I've just very rarely seen any kind of orders like this that prohibit victims or witnesses in the case from speaking before trial even begins. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting. So I delved into that a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it overall, gag orders, or, you know, what's called legally anti-dissemination orders, are really done as a way to balance the defendant's right to a fair trial, mm-hmm. the public's right to a fair trial, the prosecution and the victim's right to a fair trial, with the freedom of the press to report on that trial. So it's this real balancing act that judges should take extremely seriously, because, you know, these are rights that are outlined in the Constitution, in the Bill of Amendments. In the Bill of Rights, you've got the First Amendment, freedom of the press, that's enshrined there. And then you've got the Sixth Amendment, the defendant's right to a fair trial. So really what the judge is looking at is, you know, is there going to be such media attention to this case, where if the prosecution, the defense, or any witnesses, or any part of members of the court clerks, or members of any part of the judicial process, that if they are saying things that are not part of the court record, is that going to affect the jury pool so that the defendant cannot find people who haven't maybe been prejudiced by that? Or is it going to affect that right to a fair trial? So he's really, the judges really have to take all of that into consideration and then make a ruling on it to really try to balance all these rights. So that's where it comes from.
Was there something going on with this case? Obviously, with almost any case, there's going to be some amount of leaks going on. Has there been leaks in this that prompted an even stricter order to go in place?
You know, I didn't see anything when I first saw this expanded order go into effect, and I believe that went in. I've got it in front of me. It was on the 18th, mm-hmm. so just 2 days ago. I was looking and doing research and Googling and just seeing what has gone on. What I think the judge is doing, and you know, originally, the gag order, the original one, came from a defense request.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, can be fairly common in cases like this.
Sure.
So what I think the judge is doing is really trying to anticipate, it looks to me, of what could happen as more and more goes on in this case procedurally. You know, we've seen the probable cause affidavit be released. I think, Tony, you read that whole thing.
Yep, I did.
Which is, I mean, you really can't make this stuff up, right?
No.
I mean, if you were going to write it as fiction, it wouldn't even be that intense.
No.
It's a really intense read, as you know, because you did it. I mean, it really is. So, you know, as that comes to light, as results of a search warrant comes to light, you know, I think that probably the judge in this case was really weighing what kind of media attention are we going to get in this small town where there is this huge case where people are so involved, where there's emotion running high, where press has converged. How can I be sure to balance all these rights and make sure that I can preserve that right to a fair trial for the defendant, first and foremost, but for, and then for everyone involved. And it's really in the interest of the public as well. And when I did look at the order, what was interesting to me is in the first part of the order, it does say that based upon the stipulation of the parties and with good cause, here is the order. So this is not just the judge saying, this is what I'm doing. The parties have all agreed. And by the parties, meaning I am taking it to mean the prosecution and the defense in this case.
Have we already crossed the bridge, though? I mean, we're talking a town of 25,000 people. You have media that's already been there for months now. I mean, you have Nancy Grace camping out in front of the house. there's obviously a lot of attention there. Haven't we already crossed that bridge, though, of getting a fair trial in Moscow, Idaho, where all this took place? Are we to a point where they're going to at some point have to say this has got to be moved elsewhere for that to exist, a fair trial?
Yeah, I don't think we're quite there yet.
No. Nope.
You know, the judicial system gives the judge many alternatives to really experiment with and really use until you can really say you've gotten to that point. You know, one of them is what you just mentioned, having a change of venue. Mm-hmm. Are we going to put this somewhere else? But you know, what does that really do? This is nationwide.
Yeah.
I would believe it's worldwide.
Sure.
You know, it's everywhere. So I don't really know that a change of venue is necessarily mm-hmm. going to do a whole lot right now.
Yeah.
Another thing would be a postponement. You know, let's let the media attention die down a bit and then we move forward. That's another kind of tool that the judge would have in his toolbox. You know, another one that I have used widely in cases that I have tried and that I have seen used wisely is that you have a much more involved and intense voir dire or jury selection. You have more intense questions, more examination by the judge and by the attorneys to truly ensure that the jury panel that you yet has not been tainted by any of this media attention or by living near or in the area where this happened. So that's another one. And another is jury sequestration. That can be pretty extreme. You don't necessarily want to take, you know, 12 people out of their daily lives any more than you have to mm-hmm. on jury duty and sequestering them in a hotel away from media attention, all of that. Maybe you do that during deliberations, but to do it in an involved trial like this, which I anticipate will be a fairly lengthy trial, could be kind of extreme. But, you know, there are those tools. And any judge is going to, I would think, really weigh and balance those and try some alternatives before doing something as extreme as a change of venue that might not even get you what you're looking for here.
Sure. So you just mentioned about the trial itself. I was going to go there and ask, do you think it will make it all the way to trial or after the next, what do we have coming up here in June? That is the
probable cause
hearing. Yes. Right? I'm missing words every now and then because I'm talking about this stuff so much. The probable cause hearing. Yes. So when that happens in June, obviously it's kind of a mini trial. Both sides are able to present their cases and the judge decides, you know, if this is going to go to trial and he can plead. With what we know thus far and with that, the unsealing just the other day of the search warrant of Koberger's apartment and the listings of everything that was found there, from the outside in, it looks pretty damning. But from someone who knows the inside far more than most of us do, like yourself, is it as damning as what the public is perceiving here?
It is.
Okay.
And probably more so. And one of the reasons for that, too, is that the probable cause that is in that affidavit in the arrest warrant is based on such forensic evidence and such just really kind of boots on the ground police work mm-hmm. in terms of the location of his phone, in terms of the car, in terms of the blood that was found at the scene and then matched with DNA. So you're really depending just for that probable cause on legal witnesses, police witnesses. You know, so you're not even depending at that point on any eyewitnesses whatsoever, which makes it for prosecutors a bit easier and more predictable when you're going into a probable cause hearing. And what the prosecutors will want to do at a probable cause hearing is not have it be a mini trial. You really don't want to be putting witnesses on the stand in such an expansive way, the same way you would at trial, because the level of evidence that you have to present, the standard you have to meet, is so different. Probable cause, just meaning it is more likely than not that this crime occurred and this defendant committed it, as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, which would be the standard at trial. That is a tremendous difference. So, you know, the prosecutors don't really want to be showing their hand of their trial strategy, although all of this will have been turned over to the defense, all of the evidence in discovery. But what they really want to do is just put on enough to show probable cause and then move forward. There is really no question in my mind they have more than enough to do that.
Sure. I mean, without a doubt, they have enough to do that. The question would be, you know, guilty, not guilty as far as what he pleads, or would they allow him to plead out, you know, with a guilty to avoid the death sentence if he were to, you know, give more details on exactly what happened for the peace of mind of of the victims and their families?
Yeah, you know, those are, because certainly, you know, as we were talking about this non-dissemination order, all that we know, and we know a lot, but what we do know are kind of the facts right now that are leading to his arrest and the things that have been found in his apartment based on that search warrant. And we in the public are not privy anymore, especially to any of the victim statements or any of the conversations, the really intense emotional ones that are certainly going on between the prosecution and the victims the victims' families in this case. So, you know, that's not something I certainly want to speculate on. I think all of that is going to go into the prosecution's decision of what is a fair plea in this case, should he even want to plea. And from what I've seen so far of his, you know, the defense statements before this dissemination order, the gag order went into effect, it didn't look to me like it was in that posture. Certainly things change.
Sure.
And certainly even a probable cause hearing, there's one thing to read evidence. It's another to see it on the stand right in front of you. I think that is going to be an eye-opening experience for this defendant.
I was surprised the other day that we got the list of items that were taken out of the Koberger home. I was expecting to see more of that as we led up to June. Were you surprised that that came out already? And does that pose any sort of issues for the upcoming trial and having a fair trial with that another, you know, big dump of evidence that appears to have been, you know, found that does look, again, pretty damning?
Yeah, you know, there is something that the Justice Department says and that a lot of prosecutors will say and that the court will say as well, is that we let the public record speak for itself and let the court record speak for itself. Mm-hmm. So prosecutors are speaking through the evidence that they are giving to the court, through putting that search warrant into evidence and putting the return of the search warrant with all that evidence into the court record.
Okay.
And some of that can be done to induce a plea, to let, you know, Brian Koberger know that this is what we have on you. You know, we're coming up in June. You better think long and hard, because if we start heading towards trial, you know, this is where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a way of the prosecution sending a message, even with this gag order. You know, the defense certainly could move to have those things sealed, but they didn't. So, you know, I am not surprised that the prosecution put it into the record there and let it be there to show how strong their case is moving forward.
Because it had just been sitting there with, obviously, what we had in the original probable cause affidavit, the knife sheath, and all of the cell phone pinging, which in itself was pretty damning. So you're saying it's almost like a chess game where we're not going to make a statement or anything, but here's what we got on you. Think long and hard about where you really, truly want to go with this.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's the facts.
Sure.
It's just the facts.
Yeah.
Without any embellishment. And to my mind, that is about as powerful as it gets.
Sure.
Just right in black and white there.
I was reading another attorney had made a statement the other day to Fox News, and it eludes me for who it was. But they had made a statement that this could actually be sped up if a grand jury was seated, the prosecution was moved to have a grand jury seated earlier, that would then speed this process up and there wouldn't have to be the need or the possibility of some of the surviving roommates and such going on the stand and being cross-examined come June. Is that truly a possibility, or could we see that happen here in this case?
Well, usually it's, you know, you show probable cause through the probable cause hearing or through an indictment.
Sure.
And they certainly could impanel a grand jury and call witnesses. Whether or not they would need to call any of the surviving witnesses would be up to the prosecution. They certainly don't need it. It's to show probable cause in the grand jury. The prosecution really controls the grand jury. Mm-hmm. The defendant here has a right to appear in the grand jury should he want to. I would not imagine that would ever occur in this case. There is no defense attorney in the grand jury. Grand jury proceedings are secret.
Yes.
And the prosecution asks questions of the witness, mm-hmm. and then the grand jury is allowed to ask questions of the witnesses there. So that is something it would not, as opposed to a probable cause hearing, be an open court. Mm-hmm. And there's no, you know, no one is subject to any kind of cross-examination. Whether or not that speeds up the process, time-wise, I really don't know. I can't imagine the prosecution putting on a tremendous number of witnesses besides what they really need mm-hmm. at a probable cause hearing. But it certainly would be a way that it would not open up any of those witnesses to any kind of cross-examination or to also having to be in the public eye that way in a public court. I don't know that, in Idaho, how quickly they impanel grand juries, if they already do have one impaneled that they then could put these witnesses in front of. This would not be a very difficult presentment to a grand jury. And it certainly wouldn't be incredibly time-consuming either. Why they are going to a probable cause hearing as opposed to a grand jury indictment, I don't know. I don't know if that is just the way that that is general practice in Idaho. I think in different courts, they have different practices. In New York, when I prosecuted, we went to the grand jury. We had a certain number of time. Amount of days in which to go to the grand jury. And that is what we did. We would get an indictment. If the case merited it, the indictment would be sealed. And then the defendant would be brought into court, arraigned on that indictment and those new charges. So it's certainly something they could do to not have to have a probable cause hearing. But the defense can also ask for a probable cause hearing, and the judge may grant that. And that may happen in this case anyways.
And after June 26, assuming everything goes as is lined out right now, that is when Koberger would in fact make his plea of guilty, not guilty, or some sort of a plea deal request if they in fact were to allow one or to grant one.
Yeah, you would have a grand jury presentment.
Yep.
They would return, let's say they return an indictment that charges him with those four counts of murder.
Sure.
That would then be brought into court. The grand jury indictment would be unsealed since grand jury proceedings are sealed.
Yeah.
And then he would be arraigned on that indictment. Meaning he would be told of those charges that he had been indicted, and then he would plead again, guilty or not guilty on that indictment. And that would alleviate eliminate the need for a probable cause hearing, because the prosecution would have already demonstrated their probable cause in the grand jury.
Because it wasn't half of the reason that it's been pushed all the way to June so that there can be more discovery, so that the defense can put together a stronger case, and almost some of the public attention to it die down. If they, and again, I don't know what the Idaho laws are, if they can even do that, but if they were to do that, that could in fact speed some things up. But would they then still allow the defense to take some time, even after that, if they still need it for putting together their case in discovery?
No, that's, I am not aware of why it is scheduled in June. Mm-hmm. I imagine there's somewhat extensive discovery to be done based upon sure. everything that we've seen thus far. However, preparing for the probable cause hearing is not the same as preparing for trial.
Okay. Yeah.
And I also don't, you know, as you've said, you know, we can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah.
There is plenty of attention to this case. And when it comes back up again, even if it dies down a little bit, when it comes back up again, mm-hmm. there's going to be attention again,
sure.
you know, and that is what the gag order is really trying to kind of tone down a bit to, mm-hmm. to have fewer sources to have that kind of attention. So in terms of discovery in the trial, you know, there is a time limit, you know, mm-hmm. a speedy trial time limit speedy trial time limit within which the defendant is entitled to have his case brought to trial. That's something that the defense can waive some time, but the prosecution, you know, does need to be ready to go unless there's a compelling reason that they're not. You know, in a case like this where it is going to be fairly involved and where a trial is getting so much attention and there is going to be a great deal of discovery, that is something that usually the judge, the defense attorneys, and the prosecution will come together to figure out the trial schedule for themselves and for all the witnesses. And even though things are adversarial and contentious, mm-hmm. and I know that both parties here representing the people in Idaho, the prosecution, and then the defense representing their client, mm-hmm. although they can be adversarial and have zealous advocacy in court, what generally does happen in cases is, you know, the judge and the defense attorneys and the prosecution get together and they work out a schedule,
sure.
you know, and there is civility in doing that so that the trial can move forward in a very smooth way.
Between now and June, assuming we get to that, the next date, is there anything that you can foresee coming up that would cause issues with the prosecution of Koberger or the defense, now that we're kind of sitting here waiting, discovery is going on, what kind of legal issues may arise?
I don't really anticipate, you know, anything major. What mm-hmm. generally happens procedurally is that the defense will be going through discovery. They will be making sure that they have everything that should be turned over. And if they believe they have not received everything that they have asked for, then they can either go to the prosecution or go back to the judge to have further, you know, requests and make mm-hmm. sure they're getting what they are entitled to. And on the flip side, the prosecution will be turning over what they need to in terms of discovery and making sure that they are kind of crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's and turning all that over. You know, I would anticipate procedurally, after either an indictment or a probable cause hearing, what happens then are pretrial motions. There will be motions, most likely from the defense, to exclude certain evidence. They would try to possibly exclude the DNA testing, exclude what was found at the crime scene, exclude the search warrant and have a hearing on that, and exclude what was found in his apartment. And so then kind of dealing with whether they have cause or not. I am certainly not saying that they have cause for those things sure. or that they would be successful. But judging from everything the defense has filed thus far, they are thorough. They know what they're doing. And they are crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's and doing what they need to do for their client. And so they would be remiss and ineffective if they did not file to suppress certain evidence mm-hmm. in this case.
Sure. It's just in the yeah. interest of what they're doing and representing their
exactly.
client. The question, kind of playing devil's advocate here, and maybe we'll wrap up on this because I'm sure you've probably thought of it yeah. from the other direction too. How does mm-hmm. one defend someone like a Koberger with this type of media attention, with this amount of evidence that we're seeing in the public that clearly does not look good? Obviously, if it's your job to do so, it's your job to do so. But if you were in those shoes of being the defender of Brian Koberger, how would you be handling something like this at this point?
Oh, gosh. Well, Tony, this is why I am not a defense attorney.
Exactly.
Really?
But say you were.
I mean, it is. And look, thank goodness we have many, many dedicated, talented defense attorneys who are out there and advocating for people such as Brian Koberger in this case.
Sure.
And, you know, what I've seen so far is the defense, you know, immediately filed motions to be able to examine the crime scene, to go out and take their own pictures, take their own video and get a look at it. That was the right thing to do. They immediately filed for this gag order that we've talked about to ensure their client's right to a fair trial. Mm-hmm. That was the right thing to do as well. And as they look at, I do not know how, as a defense attorney, you can look at the mountains of evidence. And as I said, not even the kind of eyewitness testimony you might look at and think, well, are there ways that I can attack this credibility or this person's ability to see and remember what they say they saw and what they say they remember? We're not even there yet.
Sure.
We're looking at some just real, to me, solid, very detail-oriented police work based on things that are not that open for interpretation. I mean, phone records, satellite records, cell phone tower records, DNA testing. So you've got some real solid things here. Those are pretty hard to defend against. What the defense attorneys will do, as I said, are file for suppression, file for any you know, violations of their client's right to not have searches and seizures that are not done in the proper way with the proper probable cause. They will file those motions. That's one way to defend him. Another way is that they will attack this police work. They will attack the officer. They can try to attack the credibility and the actual work that the officers who did this and gathered all this evidence that we saw in the probable cause affidavit for arrest. They will certainly go against that, try to pick any, you know, put any holes in it that they possibly can, find any discrepancies that they possibly can. That's another thing that they can do. And, you know, when I look at this case and I look at this defendant, and it makes me wonder, too, he does not seem that he would meet the criteria for this at all. But one way to defend this case is to claim there is some sort of mental disease or defect with this defendant.
But in Idaho, and, I believe that there's not, you can't claim insanity in Idaho. But is there another statute or something that they could go under of, yes, mental defect? Not necessarily insane, but this person needs to be institutionalized, not necessarily in jail.
Yeah. I mean, that is the kind of other thing that's jumping out at me, because I just don't think they're going to have a real leg to stand on with any of these other general defense strategies in a case like this. And then lastly, look, if there is, you know, you look at all this evidence, we've talked about it all going out. We've talked about all the things that are even, you know, court records for us to see in the public. Another way is you negotiate a plea for your client.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes as a defense attorney, what it comes to is what kind of plea are you going to get for your client? And that sometimes is the absolute best way, oftentimes, that defense attorneys can zealously advocate for their clients, is negotiating the best possible plea for them.
Laura Gilbertson, former prosecutor, thank you so much for your input and thoughts on this case today. That's going to wrap up this episode of the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts as to not miss any breaking updates and discussions on the case as we have them. You can follow me online on Twitter at Tony B Pod. I'm Tony Bruschi. For all of us at True Crime Today, thanks for joining us.